You're listening to a DM podcast.
Hi, I'm Nigel Marsh, and this is the Five of My Life podcast, the show where five choices reveal sideways insights into the lives, opinions, and lessons of interesting people. Former politician and diplomat Brett Mason was first elected to federal parliament in 1998, going on to enjoy a long and varied career, including stints as both senator for Queensland and Australia's ambassador to the Netherlands. Also a successful author, his wonderful book Saving Lieutenant Kennedy tells the incredible story of how an Australian hero helped save the life of a young JFK. It was a delight hearing him discuss his choices. So, Brett, welcome to Five of My Life.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me, Nigel. Thank you.
I'm really excited to have you in this morning, and I'm loving your latest book. Would you mind telling us the title and the story behind it?
It's called Saving Lieutenant Kennedy, the heroic story of the Australian who helped rescue JFK. Nigel, it's about an Australian naval officer, Lieutenant Reg Evans, who, with the assistance of Solomon Islander scouts, rescued President Kennedy and his crew in August of 1943, 80 years ago, when their craft, their PT boat, PT-109, was smashed in two by a Japanese destroyer. So it's a great story, and it has clearly a great consequence. There would never have been a President Kennedy without Reg Evans.
Well, I'm thrilled that you have brought it to the public, because I'm aware of that the JFK story, but not that there was an Aussie involved. So how can that have been the case? My narrative is JFK was a hero and he saved all his troops and off he went and became the president of America. I didn't know that dear old Reg had a role to play.
That's right. It's a little bit it's hidden in the mists of time, though. In recent years, a couple of authors in Australia have written about it. And recently, Michael Adams in a podcast has touched on it yet again, which is great, because the Americans have never spoken much about it. And quite frankly, until 1960, when the interest in who saved Lieutenant Kennedy during the Second World War became a really important and a topical issue, only then did Reg Evans out himself as the rescuer and, of course, his Solomon Islander scouts. So it was it's a great story. I suppose the book also, of course, is about the birth of Australian-American friendship. And how that incident assisted President Kennedy's affection for Australia. And, of course, he wanted to come in 1963 and 1964.
Wow. And that's in all good bookshops, as they say.
It is.
Now, yeah.
It is.
Now, we start on Five of My Life always with the film choice. And you have chosen, I can never mention the name of this film without immediately hearing the music. You have chosen the 1980 one, Chariots of Fire.
Yeah. Nigel, you're right. It's the film score, the film, and it reminds me of I was lucky enough back in the late 1980s to spend a year in Cambridge, about 15 months there studying, and it was I think the happiest year really of my life, because you know I was in my mid-20s. It's a good time of life, no particular responsibilities. And it's in a ridiculously romantic place, Cambridge. You would know it. It's beautiful. I had a wonderful time, met great friends, we're still friends to this day, more than 30 years later. Did a bit of study, though it wasn't that tough. The study was actually less important than the socialising and meeting the people who remain, as I say, friends to this very day. It's a wonderful year.
What were you studying?
Criminology, strangely enough.
Criminology, right.
Crime and deviance. I did, because I was a lawyer, a Commonwealth prosecutor, actually, in my early 20s when I finished law school. And someone said, why don't you go to Cambridge and, do something about criminal law, criminology and the rest? And I thought, good idea. And I'm so glad I did. And my professors at uni, ANU where I was, were very supportive. It's one of the – well, I look back – I no doubt see things through rose-tinted glasses. I accept that. I'm quite romantic and sentimental by nature. But it was such a happy year, and I will always be very grateful that I went.
And this was in the late 80s?
88, 89, right. I think.
was it easy to get in? Or, I mean, presumably the bar's quite high.
Well, I think it was easier in those days. I think these days it's pretty hard to get in. But back then, if you had a reasonable degree, I was trained in law originally, and you had the support of your, you know, professors and my honour supervisor and the rest, they were quite happy to support my application. But I think from what I understand is it's like everything has become much more competitive. Someone said to me the other day, Nigel, but you wouldn't even get into law school today, Brett, with your marks. And I think that's true from what I understand.
So one of the famous scenes from the film is when they're doing the hurdles and they've got champagne glasses on top of the hurdles. Yeah. And there's something, I mean, I didn't go to Oxford or Cambridge, but there's something romanticised in it's sort of, it will never change. That Bride's Head Revisited, that we, you know, we are training for the Olympics, but we're going to do it with champagne and dressed in all white. Did you get the English upper class experience? Or
there is an Oxbridge style, isn't there?
Yes.
About it all. And you're right, actually, in Bride's Head Revisited, you know, Evelyn Waugh evokes that beautifully, that interwar Oxbridge of class, yes, but a sense of entitlement and privilege that, you know, none of us really have. You know, I come from a very ordinary family. But there was a bit of that at Oxford and Cambridge. But I think increasingly, of course, it's merit-based now.
Yeah.
And just because your father was an aristocrat is not quite sufficient anymore, Nigel, I'm told. But it is the most beautiful place.
And I've got a couple of friends who had that classic, you know, sort of Eton-Oxbridge experience.
Mm.
And they're both very nice, but they know everyone because you just David Attenborough, Stephen Fraser, whatever it is, you go, well, they were my contemporaries.
Yes, that's right.
So did you have any notable contemporaries that you're still in touch with?
Yes. It's funny you say that, and this is not any sort of sense of, you know, false modesty or anything, but it wasn't a hard year, you know, intellectually in that sense. But it's true, your classmates...
Yes.
And the people that were in my college and in where I was living all went on to do really well, you know, whether as academics, whether as lawyers, some made a lot of money. And it's interesting how what remains after all these years, those memories, and now the contacts. In those days, they had a thing called a fourth-class degree, a gentleman's degree. But that was sufficient because it got you in touch with the stockbrokers in London. That right. made sense. And sure. All that contacts and et cetera. Yeah, there's no question that the people, my classmates, were a talented lot and have gone on to do very, very well.
And do you ever go back to visit?
I went back once for the 30th anniversary, so just a few years ago. Sadly, we've all changed, but but I did, and I loved it. And because I'm so sentimental, you know, you walk where you walked. It's quite, well, for me, it was quite moving. For others, it probably isn't, but I thought, oh, God, you know, I was here then, and this happened. And, yeah, I haven't been back since. I sometimes worry about going back again, you know, because it's different.
Yeah.
Your time was then, and now there's all these young faces that remind me of myself a long time ago.
Now, you've mentioned sentimental three times. Mm. I am sensing that a heart was broken or something.
Hearts are always broken to a place like Cambridge, I think. It's that sort of place. As I mentioned, ridiculously romantic. And, yeah, I suppose the memories aren't necessarily bad, they can be sort of painful at times.
Yeah.
But, Nigel, you know, we move on and we make the most of it.
Well, to talk about making the most of it, we're going to come on to your book choice. And I have it in front of me here. And you have chosen a lesser-known author, Winston Churchill, A History of the English-Speaking Peoples. Now, I've only got the abridged version because there's six editions, aren't there? So this is the 900-page edited version of all of them together. Tell us why you've chosen that.
Because my mother gave the volumes to me. Well, it was four when I got it, but whatever it is, four-volume paperback version when I was in my mid-teens. And I love it. I always loved history, but I particularly loved, you know, it sounds terrible, but the battles and the all the terrible murders and the colours and the kings and the queens. And it's beautifully written, but simply written, Nigel. I find today, often reading history that you know I do for books, some works of history to me are nearly impenetrable. You know, I like books that are written simply for the layperson. And Churchill, I'm aware of some of his faults, and I know that book, and you're quite right, is quite, in a sense, imperial and, you know, awash with colonialism. I accept that. But it would be hard to say it wasn't beautifully written.
Yes.
I think anyone would say, well, it was. It's simply, and he did it with a cigar in one hand and a brandy balloon in the other, you know, late at night dictating to his secretaries. He's an extraordinary individual, but I love the use of language. And to be honest, I love the sort of romanticism about the history of the English-speaking peoples. I think we're a bit more alive today to some of the blemishes of the history of the English-speaking peoples. But when Churchill wrote that, you know, just after the war, we didn't speak of blemishes so much because there'd been a triumph over Nazism, and he had been one of the principals involved in that triumph. But now I think we would look upon that work that you have right in front of you in a different light. But I suppose I would argue that it's still beautifully written.
There's something valuable and interesting in seeing people writing from their own perspective that we know has now changed. So he's writing when he was, the centre of the world, he'd save the world. And so obviously, if you're at, nothing wrong with Melbourne University, I'm sure, but if you're at Melbourne University now in 2024, you go, you don't see the world through white man's British Empire glasses. Well, of course you don't. But if you're Winston Churchill, you're writing it in the shadow, having just saved the world. It's interesting, almost for that perspective alone. You go, so that's how a bloke who ran the world thought then. And that's not irrelevant. You go, he was a titan of humanity. The Guardian, rather sniffingly, said it's the history of things I'm interested in and my view of them. And you go, you can learn a lot about what your priorities are and what your view of the world from how you choose to write history, but that doesn't necessarily invalidate it.
I couldn't agree more, Nigel. I mean, he was born in 1874.
So yes,
in the height of Victorian power, as it were. And his dress, the way he dressed was sort of Edwardian, very unusual with the waistcoat and the bow tie and everything else. He was a product of his age, and you're quite right. We probably shouldn't judge people like Winston Churchill through the eyes of, as you say, 2023, writing in 80 years ago, just post-war. We have a habit of doing that now, and I don't think we should cancel Winston Churchill.
There's I think it's in the last appendix. He says the future is unknowable, but the past should give us hope. And you go, wow. It is. There's something when you said that you were interested in the battles and all those things. Mm. That one of the benefits of history, if it's not fresh in your own life and immediate loved ones, is you can learn from it without being emotionally damaged by it.
Yes.
Without having to put value judgments over it. You go, what can we learn from those awful things that happen, so we don't replicate the same bloody mistakes?
That's it.
Yeah. So I think, history, gosh, it's a sort of an undervalued discipline.
I couldn't agree more. And I worry these days that, even relatives of my younger relatives, that don't read very much or have no sense of history. And someone said to me the other day, a young person, oh, Brett, why would I know about President Kennedy? Didn't know who President Kennedy was, because I wasn't alive then, as if somehow, history started with their birth.
Well, that's so interesting. You said, because one of my sons nicely says, which made me realise how, we're knocking on in years, is for them, pre-Second World War is ancient history, whereas for me, it isn't. I mean, I don't know, the Boer War, I think, oh, gosh, the Boer War. But you go, for them, wow, that's sort of like unthinkably. One of my daughters said to me once, Daddy, were you alive in the 70s?
Oh, alive in the 70s, yes.
As if that was, you know, when dinosaurs roamed the planet.
Yes. I find history gives context, you know, to current problems. And it gives you also a sense of proportion. Everything isn't new. If you see things through a historical lens, many of the problems we have now in the world, you know, there are a few, you can appreciate them more, or understand them better. And I find nearly comfort in history that, you know, as Churchill says, there's still optimism. I'm not a pessimist. I'm an optimist. And I think, you know, humankind has the capacity to come through even, you know, the horrors that we're facing now, and create a better world, which sounds terribly optimistic, but I believe that. I take comfort from people like Churchill, having lived through the worst conflagration in human history. If he could say that after that, I think even with today's enormous challenges, that we can look forward to a better world.
And did he inspire you to get into the political game, or...?
No, it was never my intention. You know, it's funny. You meet men and women, particularly blokes, actually, who say they wanted to become prime minister when they were, you know, when they were 10, and they became a lawyer, and then they went into practice, all with the idea of going into parliament. I didn't. I never worked for a politician before I went into parliament. I thought I might work as a speechwriter one day.
Right.
Or perhaps a private secretary, you know, an advisor. I didn't think I'd be a politician per se. And only when I was in the Liberal Club at ANU in the 80s, and then I joined the Liberal Party when I moved to Queensland. So I think, if they're doing it, maybe I can do it as well, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
Because you see your contemporaries and others, and you think, oh, I think I can do as well as that. So it was partly really just the opportunity. And because I thought that there should be a bit of a shake-up, you know, I was very lucky to win a pre-selection when I did. There's a lot of luck in politics. There's a lot of timing and luck. But I was lucky, and I've never regretted it. I've never regretted going into politics. It was a wonderful time of life, but a very difficult one as well.
Right. And what would be the biggest difficulty?
The difficulty is that you have enormous expectations from the public. To be frank, you can never do enough. I remember in the 90s, you'd remember, you know, John Howard and Peter Costello, and they paid off national debt, and we had an extraordinarily wealthy, Australia was extraordinarily wealthy on every index, in the UN indexes, et cetera. We were right at the top. And you can say that. You can say, but Australia's doing better than nearly any other, you know, country in the world, as we were certainly then. But that's, people say, yeah, but that's last week. What are you doing for me next? In other words, you can never really satisfy the public's want and sometimes need for more and for better. So it's an extraordinarily difficult profession because you can never satisfy your constituents ultimately. And secondly, of course, it's really busy. It can be very difficult and sometimes highly stressful. And then you have issues, of course, of character. One thing about politics, Nigel, is in politics, in the end, everyone gets found out.
Right.
So if you're good, bad, or indifferent, you know, character is king. And believe me, your character shines through in politics. Not, you know, maybe after a year or two, but if you've been here, you know, a decade or so, everyone knows what you're like, for right. good or for bad.
Because it's so full on, you can't fake it.
You can't fake it. You can fake it for a bit, maybe,
yeah.
But you certainly can't fake it for a decade.
How are you with... They go, oh, Brett, thank you for coming. We'd like you just to do a quick little 10-minute speech. And then they push you in front of a group of 80 people. And yeah. Off the top, you've got to speak. Are you comfortable with that?
I am now.
Terrifying.
It is, but you get used to it. And by that I mean you're at a meeting and they say, oh, Brett, you won't need to speak. But if I'm sitting there, I grab a pen and a beer coaster, you know, and I'll write a couple of notes just in case.
Yes.
I prepare because I think they might. And sure enough,
yep.
What you say is right. Oh, Brett, or Senator Mason might want to say a few words. And I was very gracious and smile. that can be, it could be, you know, it could be hundreds of people. So you've got to sort of always have your wits about you.
Yeah.
But you do get used to it. Even right. though you think, God, I used to think, because I'm actually quite shy.
Right.
People think, what? But actually, I had to come out of your shell if you want to be a politician. And you just get used to it because you have to.
Yeah, you're always asked. And then representing the nation. I've got quite a romantic view of that. So please correct me if I'm wrong, but you were the face of this glorious nation in Holland.
Yes.
For how many years?
Gee, for over 3 years, and it's a wonderful job. It's in The Hague, the embassy was, and The Hague is interesting. So the job is partly about the relationship between Australia and the Netherlands.
Yep.
And the other part, of course, is because it's The Hague, it's the home of public international law. So the International Court of Justice, the International Criminal Court, Permanent Court of Arbitration, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, all in The Hague. And so your job is as a diplomatic representative to those institutions. And it's a terrific job. I loved it. But as I said, I think off tape, I was given the job really as a consolation prize because I had to leave Parliament.
Right. And why did you have to leave Parliament?
Ah, well, because it's a long story, but let me just cut to the chase. In Queensland, the parties merged between the Liberal Party and the National Party.
Yep.
On the Senate ticket, one and two are safe. Three is, unsafe. And so the Liberals had number one and number three on the ticket, right? Going for both number one would have been me and George Brandis, who was the former Attorney General and High Commissioner to London, and also ultimately Senate Leader. And as Tony Abbott later said to me, we all thought you'd beat him. And I did too. And the party, I'm not saying anything that's not now widely.
Sure.
The irony, having to leave politics because you were too popular.
Right.
And I could go on about this, but it was extraordinarily difficult because Tony Abbott, I'd helped him become elected leader, not just vote for him, but did other things for him. And so he had to terminate my career. And his argument would be, to be frank, would be, Brett, it's not about individual justice. It's about, the greater good, the team. Does that make sense? And we couldn't have you knocking off the Attorney General in a pre-selection. And he's Prime Minister. It's not about fairness or justice. It's about utility. It's about expediency. It's about the greater good. So Tony, I always give him credit for this, that in the end, he was very honest about it.
Right.
But at the time, of course, he couldn't be too honest, but did, they made arrangements for me to be sent to The Hague as ambassador, which I've always said was the best job of my life. It was wonderful time.
Yeah. Not a bad consolation prize. So how are you with sort of setbacks and failure? Do you go into a funk or do you readily adapt?
I was furious about having to leave Parliament when I did. And I don't try to sugarcoat it.
Yeah.
Because people say, Brett, but left at a time of your own choosing, I resigned from Parliament, which is not quite true. And you went to The Hague. I said, yeah, but I didn't want to go then. I had been Shadow Minister for Universities and Research, and I'd done all the work, the preparatory work, going into the 2013 election. And I was keen to do that. But then, I was, as Tony later admitted, demoted and then sent away to save George Brandis' pre-selection. And I was... I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I'm absolutely furious because it takes years of work to get there. And finally, it was, my time. You know how it is.
Yeah.
Old enough and experienced enough. And it was, and I'd done all the preparatory work. So I was furious. And it's a funny thing. In a way, at one level, I still look back and go, if only I'd have a chance to do it. But it's funny. Not only did I enjoy The Hague immensely, I think no one will ever admit this, but I think I was then offered chair of the Council of the National Library of Australia. I think that was, again, part of the consolation prize.
We're sorry, Brett. Here's another one.
It was very kind of the government to do that. I was delighted to do it, and I'm still there. It was wonderful. But It was awful at the time. But strangely, you know, Nigel, with the books and the writing, in a sense, I wonder if I was still there, and I suspect I would have, you know, for certain, you know, nearly for certain, or would have won the pre-selection if I hadn't been demoted and sent off, would I be happier? I'm not certain about that. You know, I'm not certain that if I hadn't gone to The Hague and hadn't written the books, I doubt it. I might be a crotchety, very angry old man, you know, with sort of less vitality than I, you know, I still have. So I'm not certain. If you'd asked me this question 5 or 6 years ago, I still would have been seething with fury.
Yeah.
Not so furious now, I think, because of the books and other things.
I really appreciate you taking that question in the spirit in which it was asked, because it's fine to be right royally pissed off. And in my life, I've had some roadblocks that similarly, I wouldn't have written Fat 40 and Fired if I wasn't Fat 40 and Fired. Now, I wouldn't have chosen that at the time. And at the time, I thought my life was over.
Mm.
Looking back 20 years later, best thing that ever happened to me, which is, you know, if someone says it to you at the time, you want to punch them in the face.
That's right.
But I love the fact that you honestly took that question on and you go, yeah, you never know, the sliding doors thing. And the thing is, you haven't got a choice. You can't go into a time machine and change it. It is, you know, that cliche. It is what it is.
It is. That's right. I was furious at the time, and I don't worry. I told the Prime Minister and everyone that would listen. And Tony Abbott was, you know, in the end. I mean, I like Tony. I know there's a lot of criticism of Tony in various places, but I found to deal with him, he was actually honest when he could be. And it's a very strange thing, Tony. He's nearly gentle with you. Maybe it's this priestly training, but he doesn't seem, he seems to really dislike conflict. So when we were talking, he's quite worried about, you know, people becoming highly excited. And,
right.
It's very interesting. He seemed to really dislike conflict with people he liked, if that makes sense.
Yes, it does.
So I still have a lot of time and respect for Tony, for other reasons as well, actually. But he has lifelong friendships, which I always admire. You know, I've spoken to his mates, and they said, you know, Tony's just like he always has been, except more. I still respect him, but at the time, I thought, after what I did for you, this is how you repay me? Ooh, you can imagine.
Now, the third choice on Five My Life is always the song, and we add every single song to the Five My Life Spotify playlist. So it is a sensationally eclectic, algorithm-busting playlist, because yours will be different to Gillard's, will be different to Albanese's, different to John Eel's, different to Will Anderson's. And they're all, in the main, pretty bloody good songs, because people have chosen them on Five My Life. And you happen to have chosen a song from my all-time favourite artist. You've chosen Morning Has Broken by Cat Stevens.
Morning has broken like the first morning. Blackbird has spoken like the first bird.
I love the song, and I know it should be a song of, it is a song of hope and, well, recreation, as Cat Stevens says. But I remember it at the time for its beauty, and because I was in Cambodia with the United Nations Transitional Authority in Cambodia, working as a human rights police trainer in the northwest of Cambodia. I was by myself with a Cambodian interpreter and training assistant. And what happened is I had one of those old, you know, tapes you used to buy, pirated, of course, a couple of cents it cost in the Phnom Penh market. And I had batteries in a cassette player because the electricity didn't work. And I played it. And why I remember it so starkly is because I was very lonely. I was by myself with a training assistant, you know, and much worse, I was really sick. I'd had a blister on my foot and it got infected. And I remember my training assistant, who'd been a medic in war, said, he called me Mr. Brett, you know, Brett, he'd say, you must go to see the doctor or the hospital. And I said, it'll get better. We think things get better. It got worse and worse. and it hurt so much, and my leg ballooned up, and I thought, you know, I've got to get out of here. And I felt so sick. And I remember that night playing Morning Has Broken, terribly upset. And I had a bottle of Mekong whiskey, which is about 50 cents US then, a bottle of Mekong whiskey and a packet of Lucky Strike cigarettes. it's 30 years ago. It's a long time ago. And I remember having some of that Mekong whiskey and feeling terribly low. And fortunately, Marley, my training assistant, went to the police. They got hold of Phnom Penh, and they sent a Russian helicopter to pick me up.
Right.
Medevac me back to Phnom Penh, to the German field hospital there, when they went, oh dear, you're in trouble, you know. But fortunately, because I was young and fit, they gave me the antibiotics and I got better very quickly. But, you know, without antibiotics, well, I wouldn't be here today, Nigel, ladies, for sure. You know, I was sweating, and I could hardly stand up.
Right.
I was 31 years old or something.
So what an incredible career. So Holland, Cambodia, what took you? How did you get that role? How did you get to be there?
I was, as an academic, so I was lecturing in criminology and criminal justice at QUT in Brisbane. And I had a friend who worked for the UN, and he said, Brett, we need people that know about human rights and can train police. You've had some experience in that. I went across for a trial period, if that makes sense. That went well, and so they invited me back, and I went back. And I loved it. And you know, when you're young, it's all great. It doesn't matter. It's all, you know, sure, you're out the sticks, and things were a little bit hairy at the time of the election because the Khmer Rouge was still around, and you know, where's Pol Pot? Yeah, it was all that.
Yeah.
Because I found it exciting. I thought, this is terrific. I'm not so sure I'd find it so terrific now, frankly, but back then, you know, 30 years ago, I thought it was wonderful. And I loved doing it. And the Cambodian people meant a lot more to me because of the horror, you know, Tol Sleng, you know, the place where they tortured Cambodian citizens. This pyramid of skulls, which I spoke about in my first speech to Parliament, you know, the sort of the horror of Pol Pot and totalitarianism. And really it was that, Nigel, that pyramid of skulls, I think, that made me more and more interested in politics as a way to ensure that didn't happen again.
Well, it goes back to your wonderful book choice where, you know, we need to learn, study history. Like you, I am an optimist. We might evolve to a stage where that type of thing is no longer possible, but it's been going on forever.
Yes.
In every part of the world. And what now, which is it's distressing, but it's a good thing, is we are aware of it because of the internet.
Yes.
But back in the 7th century, if some mad dictator was slaughtering half the population, well, you wouldn't know about it if you were in a different hemisphere. Well, how would you?
That's right.
Yeah. Gosh.
And my training assistants had been obviously through that. Through Pol Pot, they'd lived through that, and then they had lived through the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia. And then, of course, Hun Sen took over, who's still there.
Wow.
Hun Sen is still there, the longest serving, I think, prime minister, head of government, in the world now, Hun Sen. So he was there when I was there. But I had this enormous sympathy for the Cambodian people. You know, they're this beautiful people, and they're quite gentle people, but you know, obliterated and made a country that went mad.
Mm.
It was awful, but...
You'd be killed if you had glasses? Is that what...
Yeah, you and I wouldn't last too long.
That's right, because you're an intellectual. So they've... Awful. Well, we're going to hopefully change pace and we move to your fourth choice, which is the place, and you have chosen Canberra.
I grew up there. I was born in Canberra, and it's funny, I keep going back, you know, with Parliament, of course, and then... the National Library, of course. I'm back later next week, and I grew up there. And you know, the sights of, and the sounds, and the smells of a place stay with you that you grew up with. So whether it's the kookaburras and the magpies and the smell of the wattle at our place in Aranda, it never goes. And it's Canberra is a place of four seasons, and I think because I had such a sunny childhood. Again, I romanticise everything, I'm sure, but I think of my childhood as a wonderful time. And what's the what's that phrase, that childhood lasts a lifetime? For me, it's been a sort of a ballast, nearly like a security ballast, nearly for a lifetime, an interesting life. And I'm very grateful for my parents for that.
Tell us about your parents.
Well, they're both, they had us all when they were very young, as they did in the early 60s. You know, that was very common in the early 20s. And Dad was a newsagent. And I used to have a go at him because I said, Dad, back in the 60s and the 70s, you sold cigarettes to underage kids, you know. But he passed away a few years ago. He got Parkinson's in his 40s. Poor fellow. Yeah, it's awful. But my mother's still with us. And both of them, Dad retrained, went back to uni, became a journalist. He worked for Mitsubishi, worked for the United States Embassy, worked for the Australian Public Service and elsewhere. And Mum also had journalistic training. And I think, you know, as parents, they were very positive. Getting back to your point before, Nigel, they, you know, you do whatever you want. And my mother in particular, you know, who left school at 14 or 15 in Brisbane in the 1950s, was always, you can do that, you can do that. And I thought, oh, I can't do that. Yes, you can. And you, I think as a child, then indeed as a teenager, you need a bit, not of pushing, but perhaps a prodding and rise open to the possibilities. And my parents always did that.
And how many were there of you? How many brothers and sisters?
I'm one of four. So there's three boys and then a gap, a 10-year gap to my younger sister.
And what number are you?
Oh, number two. So right. I have an elder brother who walked across Australia and wrote a book about it. He was made a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society and got a gold medal for the first to walk solo across Australia from, it was a Byron Bay to, I think, Steep Point in Western Australia with camels, you know, back in the late 1990s. And he's written a book about it. But he was also in the French Foreign Legion.
Wow.
And published a book. It sold really well. David's a very interesting fellow.
What's the Foreign Legion book called? I think I might have read
something with the devil. Yeah, yeah, to march with the devil.
Yeah, you mean those guys aren't messing around.
No, David didn't mess around, and he's fortunately he was never horrible to me or my younger brother Richard. Never, he wasn't like that. But he wasn't the sort of guy you want to mess with on a rugby field.
No, right. So your last choice on Find My Life is always people's possessions, and you have chosen cufflinks from the King and Queen of the Netherlands. Tell us all about that.
Goes back to the time I was the ambassador to the Netherlands, and I happened to be there when King Willem Alexander and Queen Maxima decided to make, in offence, their first state visit, as the royal visit to Australia in 2016, which was the 400 years since Dirk Hartog hit the Western Australian coast in 1616.
Right.
So it's 400 years later. And it was a wonderful trip, and you're not supposed to, of course, talk about what you say to the king or what he says, but I'm sure His Majesty wouldn't mind. I did ask him. I said, "Sir, have you been to the Abrolhos Islands and, you know, the site where Dirk Hartog landed?" He said, "Oh, yes, of course, Ambassador. I've been there. I've swum there. I've got the T-shirt." So he was terrific, as was the Queen. In fact, the King, even at one stage, he can fly a plane, of course. So he's a very modern monarch. Right. So I'm very fond of the terrific to travel with, and the Dutch people, they're a bit reserved and a little bit direct, but it was a wonderful time. And at the end of their trip to Australia, I was called in just with the King and the Queen, and His Majesty said, "Now, Ambassador, look, I've got something for you." And he gave me these beautiful cufflinks. I don't wear them because I don't want to lose them. But it's a possession that I have loved, and it reminds me of, you know, a wonderful time in the Netherlands, and I'm very grateful for that.
Tell us a bit about monarchy in general and monarchy re-Australia.
The European monarchs are fairly, I suppose they're perhaps less ostentatious perhaps than the British monarchy. The Dutch monarchy, whether it could be the Belgian monarchy, you know, the Scandinavian monarchs and so forth. The King of the Netherlands was, to me, and I'm sure he wouldn't mind me saying this, was very much like an ambassador at large for the country.
Right.
And his brother, Prince Constantine, for example, worked on all sorts of things in the Netherlands to promote trade and infrastructure. and Prince Constantine was a terrific fellow as well. But it's very much a working monarchy, modern, not too much flummery, you know. It's fairly cut back, but by nature, the Dutch are quite republican, but they don't mind the king and the queen, and there'd be no real push, even all sides of politics, no one's pushing for the end of the monarchy, so long as it, you know.
Stay in your lane.
Yes, and they do that, and the king has a role there that the Dutch people appreciate. There's no real republican movement of note in the Netherlands. In Britain, clearly, it's a larger part of culture. They have a larger footprint, and it's, I suppose, particularly in the English-speaking world, it's the monarchy that's most, talked about and gossiped about. We can never get away from the monarchy.
So there's something which, I know it's desperately unfashionable, but is if they, whatever the phrase is, stay in their own lane and don't lord it over anyone, there is something in old institutions that are imperfect, but you just should be slightly cautious before you completely throw them away. So I don't know the first thing about Holland, so I'll use that as an example, not England. But just pretend you go, well, it's a completely outdated institution. We're going to disband the king and queen of Holland. How would that help anything?
Yes.
I mean, if it says, they're not doing any harm.
Yes.
And you go, well, how would that help? It might satisfy some sort of, I don't know, bloodlust, class warfare. But you go, but if actually they are working and doing something, then it's a non, with respect to politicians, it's a non-political appointment role where they're just trying to help. So I know that sounds very naive, but you go, I quite like the fact that there's people in various countries whose job is to help the people of the nation that you happen to be born in.
I agree with every word you've said. Continuity and a sense of the monarchy in the Netherlands is a place where people can rally around. So during the Second World War, you know, Queen Wilhelmina, and then Queen Juliana, and then Queen Beatrix, and now King Willem Alexander, people can rally around the king, and he doesn't, to use your phrase, he doesn't stray outside his lane. He's a figurehead, and his entire life, and that of his family, is devoted to the celebration of the state of the Netherlands. And I think that's a good thing. Now, I'm obviously quite conservative, and I think that the monarchy certainly has a place in those European nations where it exists. In fact, there was a restoration that in Spain, as you're aware. It's good and bad in a way, but I think generally it can be a good thing.
It was hilarious if you actually imagine if you actually are the queen or you actually are the king. You can't get promoted. The only thing that you can be judged on is your outcomes. The history books will write, your reign was a disaster because you did the square root of fuck all for anybody, or you were a reforming monarch who really helped the poor or whatever.
It's an interesting institution. I tend to be a monarchist. That would be my view here in Australia, even though the monarch's obviously clearly in London. I think we can have our cake and eat it with a monarchy. I understand most of my friends some are Republicans, some are fierce Republicans, but I still think that the monarchy adds something in this country. I've met Her Majesty the Queen, and I've met Prince Charles as he then was. I think as a figurehead, they do add something without costing us very much. And I don't mean costing it just in money, Nigel. Yeah. I mean more broadly.
Yeah.
I think it can be a figure from, in a sense, from outside, makes it even slightly easier.
Right, so we're going to come to the sixth choice on Five of My Life. I can't wait to hear who you are going to nominate that you would like to hear next on Five of My Life and why.
How about Tony Abbott?
Hey, dear old Tony, and why would you want... do you want me to tell him, listen, mate, you need to call up Brett and apologise?
No, because it's funny, because I think he's one of the most interesting and insightful former prime ministers and indeed politicians this country's ever had. And at the moment, he's on this civilizational quest, as he says, to save the West and Western history and Western institutions. And I have watched a couple of his performances recently on YouTube. And in many ways, Tony is getting better as he gets older. So, I'm more interested in what Tony says today than perhaps I was in Parliament, because in a sense, he's less circumscribed now. He can actually say what he thinks. And it has resonance in given some of the, you know, the conflicts in the world at the moment. I find Tony a fascinating individual.
So I'm really glad you've nominated him, because I've had Gillard and Rudd and Albo on, and we are a completely non-political show.
Sure.
The fact that we've had those three on is they said yes. I invited Howard and Morrison and they said no. So I would love to get, I'd love it if Tony would say yes, because then it would stop people saying to me, I only interview left-wing people, which is not bloody true. Brett, mate, you have been a legend to respond to this challenge in the spirit in which it's offered. So thank you so much, mate.
A real pleasure, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the show, and thank you for all your messages with guest suggestions and feedback on the episodes. The Five of My Life audience really is a lovely, engaged community. Please do keep the messages coming in. The best way is through my website. And if you have a friend who you feel might enjoy a particular guest, please do forward the episode on. I do the show on my own, so without a marketing budget, word of mouth really is the only way of people discovering the show.